In its quest to provide an open forum for discussion of controversial issues, this station allows hosts and their guests to express themselves without any significant censorship. You are advised that any view expressed by the host or their guest are not necessarily the views of the owners or management of TogiNet Radio, Togi Entertainment, or the Owners Group, Inc.
Welcome to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com. And hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com and 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Officer Radio is your source for the latest news, trends, and issues facing the law enforcement community. Join us each week as Officer Borelli and his guest examine, dissect, and discuss the issues facing our industry. Call in live and join the conversation to get your voice heard. Now, let's get to it. It's Officer Radio, live with Frank Borelli on Officer.com.
Good day. Welcome to Officer Radio, brought to you by Officer.com. I'm your host, editor for Officer.com, Frank Borelli. I'll be joined by a couple of guests today as our show focuses on active shooter response evolution. School attacks, while always horrendous and dating farther back in our country than most people realize, didn't really become front page news until the attack at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. I believe that the nation's response to that event was due in part to the fact that it was ongoing while satellite television reporting vans and hovering helicopters were broadcasting. It's one thing to hear about such an event on the news the next day. It's quite another to watch as scared school children stream out of a building while you can still hear gunshots coming from the building behind them. The public reacted as one would expect, and law enforcement professionals from coast to coast had to change how they'd done business for about three decades. We'll get to that in a little bit. Joining us on today's show is going to be, I have two guests. First is going to be Sergeant Al Garcia. He's a retired sergeant, an Army veteran having served in the 82nd Airborne, a veteran SWAT operator, and now the owner-operator of one of the best respected training organizations in our country today, School Violence Solutions. Sergeant Garcia and I will be discussing his participation in the Rhode Island Governor's Panel Committee, which examined the growing threat of school violence, specifically active shooter events, and delineated protocols and policies to mitigate the threat as much as possible. We'll also talk about Sergeant Garcia's experience across the past decade, both as a SWAT operator and as an active shooter response instructor. We'll tap into his experience in the northeastern part of our country to see if he has any thoughts on how our response has evolved, what we could be doing different, better, etc. Finally, we'll talk a bit about his company, School Violence Solutions, and its training approach for this particular threat response. My second guest today is going to be Mr. Vaughn Baker, a veteran SWAT officer, trainer, and president of Strategos International, another well-known and highly respected training organization that operates internationally. Mr. Baker and I are going to talk about the differences in approach, outlook, policy, and more around the country that he's experienced as he's traveled training officers for active shooter response. Further, I'll ask Mr. Baker what his thoughts were as a veteran SWAT officer when the active shooter revolution, if you will, if you want to call it that, began sweeping the country. I know some law enforcement special operations officers who felt that SWAT work was being given to patrol officers, and they were concerned that it was the beginning of a trend. As a side note, I think that as violence spreads in our communities and gets pushed more into the limelight of the mainstream media, we'll see an ever-growing demand for patrol officers to handle higher-risk situations. Something else I'll discuss with Mr. Baker is the various groups or organizations that Strategos trains. Strategos doesn't restrict itself to only teaching law enforcement. I know some folks in law enforcement take umbrage with that, but he and I are going to talk about it, and we'll get his feel on that and why it is the way it is. Our third segment of the show today, starting about 1:40, give or take a few minutes, is without a scheduled guest. That would be the perfect time for you, our listeners, to call in with your thoughts, concerns, suggestions, anything you have to say regarding active shooter response. During that segment, I'll talk some more about active shooter history in the United States and some of the problems, some of the acceleration we've seen in the past 3 to 4 decades. The numbers of active shooter events where schools are concerned are really staggering, and certainly we've seen them occur in places other than schools. Throughout the show, as time permits, we'll take calls from you, our listeners. The number to dial in is 877-864-4869. That's 877-864-4869. If you want to share a comment, question, observation, or other thought, please don't hesitate to dial me up. If for any reason you're uncomfortable calling, feel free to send me an email. The email address is frankborelli@officer.com. No dits, dots, dashes, or spaces, all one word, frankborelli@officer.com. For my all of my law enforcement listeners, I know you guys will enjoy this. That's Frank, Robert, Adam, Nora King, Baker, Ocean, Robert, Edward, Lincoln, Ida, at officer.com. All right, before I forget to mention it, today's show will be archived on officer.com on our radio page as well as our podcast page. To find it for reference or future listening, just go to officer.com. On the top navigation bar, click on the Media Center. In our Media Center, on the blue navigation bar, you'll see the link for officer.com radio right next to the link for our podcast library. You might want to bookmark that page, as some of our future shows are going to be issues just like this one does, and they might serve as good reference material. I especially hope that's true. As you well know, hopefully, officer.com has both a Facebook fan page and a Twitter feed. Any updates we plan for the radio show, scheduled guests, etc., will be posted and tweeted accordingly. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Not only do we appreciate the interaction, but it allows us to serve your information needs better. So with all of that out of the way, let's get into this topic of active shooter response evolution. Now, what really gets me is our history of active shooter goes in this country, documented, goes all the way back to 1891. In Newburgh, New York, where a disgruntled employee, if I remember correctly, and no, folks, I wasn't around in 1891. I'm old, but I'm not that old. A disgruntled employee took a shotgun and started shooting at the students on the playground. Several students were injured. None were reported killed. But 1891, well over 100 years ago, 120 years. If we knew about school attack, the violence potential that long ago, and I'm not saying anybody's done anything wrong, but I have to wonder why our response protocols didn't change until 1999. Something to think about, and we'll come back to it. Moving forward from 1891, we find attacks that occurred in a number of years, and we're through them. In 1927 was very notable, and for those of you who don't know, you need to really pay attention. This is another one of those landmark years, 1927, 38 years after the attack in Newburgh. This attack gets committed in Bath, Michigan, and is the first documented use of explosives in a school attack in the United States. Dynamite in a boiler room was detonated by a disgruntled employee, notice that theme, causing the evacuation of students to an outdoor rally point. The documented research reveals that a secondary explosive device was detonated near that rally point, resulting in 45 dead students with 58 more injured. I mean no offense to anyone at Virginia Tech, but reporters believe it was the deadliest attack on a school in our nation's history, that Virginia Tech was the deadliest attack on a school in our nation's history. They're just simply wrong. It was the deadliest attack committed solely with firearms, the explosive attack on that elementary school in Bath, Michigan in 1927, 80 years before Virginia Tech occurred, was the deadliest to date. You know, we skip forward 9 years to 1936. We had another attack, 1949, 13 years after that, 1954, 5 years after that. But you look at this spread out, that's only five of them, from 1891 to 1954. You know, there's a big gap there, 60-some-odd years. In 1966, 12 years after the one in 1954, we have a school attack. And it's 75 years after our first documented school attack in the United States. 1966 also marks, at a minimum, the seventh serious attack. There might have been other ones in there, but when we talk about major ones that made the news, history, so on and so forth, seventh serious attack. For reference, if you want to go to Google, just Google active shooter, and you can get a complete list of attacks that have been committed, broken down by elementary, secondary, and post-secondary educational institutions. It has the information, the dates, the number of casualties, so on and so forth. I know some of, I'm sure that some of our listeners know what happened in 1966 that changed how law enforcement does business. Combining various sniper incidents, riots, and more, the Texas Tower incident is actually credited with causing the creation of special weapons and tactics teams in our country, SWAT teams. On August 1st, 1966, Charles Whitman barricaded himself in an excellent sniper's position, and from that position shot 46 people. He killed 15, including an unborn child, and he wounded 31 others. Since no SWAT teams existed at that time, the situation was resolved by two courageous officers who stormed that tower and did what they needed to do, neutralizing Whitman. Therefore, thereafter, around the country, SWAT teams started popping up. I've always said they were hatched because it's a running joke between me and some of my friends that are SWAT officers. I believe they're a little bit cold-blooded, and cold-blooded creatures are hatched. They're not born. So SWAT teams start popping up. With the creation of the SWAT teams, response protocols for patrol changed. No more was the responding officer always responsible for handling whatever circumstance he found. Instead, if the circumstances were special or risky, whatever, he could simply set up a perimeter, call for SWAT, and then wait. And that was the protocol that existed essentially from 1966 to 1999 when we changed how we did business again. Now think about that. Up until 1966, if you were a patrol officer or police officer, you had to deal with whatever you came across. From 66 to 99, a 33-year spread, patrolmen had the responsibility of setting up a perimeter, feeding intel, and just holding their position, just waiting. Now, I know some folks who think that SWAT actually means for sit, wait, and talk, not special weapons and tactics. But when you think about the sit and wait part, that's actually what we demanded our patrol officers to do from 66 to 99. By policy, protocol, and training, we said sit and wait, take no action. Let SWAT come and handle it. I know that ate some folks up. I know some other folks thought that was the way to go. We dealt with both in our active shooter training. We'll discuss that more. We're coming up on our first break. When we come back, we'll have Sergeant Al Garcia with us, and we'll get into this topic a little bit deeper. We appreciate you listening, and we hope you enjoy today's topic. Feel free to call in again. I'll repeat the number when I come back.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. In May of 2011, a small brown-eyed boy proudly showed off the law enforcement buttons he had pinned to his shirt in honor of his dad, an officer killed in the line of duty 6 years ago. Then the reality set in. This boy was just a few days away from his sixth birthday. He never got the chance to meet his dad, nor did thousands of children whose parents' names are forever etched into the living memorial in Judiciary Square. Join us in 2012 as we launch Officer World Expo in Washington, D.C. in our effort to reduce the intolerably large number of officers who didn't get to go home to their families. OfficerWorldExpo.com, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
The Way of the Toddler with hosts Lita and Lori Hamilton is a show unlike any other parenting program you've ever heard. Zen Masters in Diapers? Yes. Join us Tuesday afternoons at 5, 4 Central here on TogiNet as we celebrate parenthood as a spiritual path for a journey to inner peace. With thought-provoking and spiritually compelling guests, each week Lita and Lori will explore how our children help us with the lessons we came here to learn, adding deeper meaning to our lives and relationships while giving you valuable gems to add to your unique parenting toolkit. Check out the website, thewayofthetoddler.com. With great humor and honesty, Lita and Lori will demonstrate how inner peace is possible, even when surrounded by poopy diapers and piles of laundry, and what we can learn from the innate wisdom and natural spirituality of our Zen Masters in Diapers. It's The Way of the Toddler with Lita and Lori Hamilton, Tuesday afternoons at 5, 4 Central, here on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com, and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Morelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
Hey there, welcome back. Joining us in this segment in just a moment is going to be Sergeant Al Garcia. First, I'd like to remind you this number to call in if you'd like to comment, 877-864-4869. Now, Sergeant Al Garcia, Army veteran, 82nd Airborne, SWAT operator, retired now point. He's a veteran trainer. He's doing a lot in the Northeast. I want to welcome Sergeant Al Garcia to the show. How you doing today, Al? Hello? I heard a brief moment of Al's voice, but it sounds like we might have a bad connection. Let's try this again.
Frank, you got me?
There you go. How you doing, Sergeant Garcia?
Good. How are you, sir? What's going on today?
I am well. We're talking about active shooter response evolution. You know, it's a topic. You and I went to school together for this to become active shooter instructors, I guess, a little more than a decade ago, right? Back in 2000? Was that when it was?
Yeah, good thing I went to the academy when I was only 14, so, you know, I retired. You know, I'm only 35 now, so things are great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like 100 years ago, Frank.
It does seem like it, but, you know, 10 years isn't that long, although things can really significantly change. Let me ask you something. You've had opportunity to do something unique. As part of the governor's panel there in Rhode Island, you know, you got to influence some of the policies and protocols and stuff that happens. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that worked and what came of it?
Sure. I was appointed to the governor's statewide steering committee on school safety a couple of years ago, and we were able to leverage government to pass laws which mandated schools to actually do some type of drill other than a fire drill. In regards to school safety around school shooter attacks and things of that nature. We also, it was kind of a bifurcated plan where after we did that and influenced government to change laws, we also set out to empower teachers and educational staffs through presentations, kind of informing them on what to do, how to do it, what to expect, you know, historical overviews and things that were prior to us doing that stuff, were reserved to only law enforcement. You know, as you know, when this we first started training, you know, the impetus for change started at Columbine, and we did kind of these cloak and dagger things at schools, you know, on Saturday afternoons and Sunday nights, and nobody needed to know, and we all pulled up in unmarked cars, and we ran in, and we did our active shooter training and protocols, and right. And then we got out of there. And, you know, that kind of didn't work because this beast still bites. So, you know, we took kind of a different approach and said, you know what, the more people that are informed, the more people that are prepared, the better. And so, you know, we kind of took that approach, and it was very, very, very well received. You know, I think educators found out that there are dozens of other things to do besides just panic when something like this happens.
Well, let me ask you something now. Is Rhode Island, to your knowledge, the only state that's actually set a mandate for such training?
I don't know. I believe that we are one of a few. It's been a while since we had put that mandate in place. There may have been other states that have enacted laws. It is, like I said, it's punishable by a misdemeanor if a school head, principal, or whoever does not have one or two of these drills a year. And it can be as simple as a tabletop exercise with their school safety committee. Here's what we should do. Here's what I want you to do. Here's what, you know, the evac plan, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't have to be a big complex thing. But, you know, I think we are one of very few. It's unfortunate.
Well, it is unfortunate if it's not being mandated. How did, I can just imagine that some of the administrators at law enforcement agencies weren't real happy with having that mandate placed on them, but how did it get accepted by the school administrators and, you know, the people that ran the school board and stuff? Were they in favor of it?
Well, Frank, you know, we live in a world of you know, we all seem to live in it'll never happen here, USA, and only the crime fighters and the military types seem to know that that's not the case. So it was a hard sell at first. But now, you know, it's become kind of one of those things that they know they need to do. So, and they know it's something for the good. It's not something, that's, you know, kind of the quote unquote waste of time, or we have other things that could, you know, we could be using our time, better with. You know, they're looking at this as something that could, you know, impact lives.
Well, it's good that they finally get the message, I suppose, but that doesn't mean they go about it in a motivated fashion. And I think it's a statement you'll agree with, that it's a shame people don't consider the impact on the safety of the children first and foremost. That, you know, we all worry about our own issues. We worry about the headache involved, the scheduling involved, the logistics involved, rather than just pure and simple going, hey, if this is going to save lives of kids, then we need to do this and be motivated about it.
Frank, we've for all intents and purposes, and kudos to the fire service, we've beaten that fire threat in public schools. And how have we done that? We've mandated laws on the state, local, and federal level that schools have to be constructed in a certain way and have to have fire alarms and have to have sprinkler systems and have to have backups to the backups ad nauseum. We haven't lost a kid in a public school fire in I don't know how long. We've lost over 300 children since 1993 to school shooter events, and it's a shame that, you know, we're still taking this head-in-the-sand approach to any type of school shooter, active shooter, workplace violence, workplace shooter protocols and mandates. You know, we had a problem this year off the coast of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, where we had white shark sightings. They're coming, you know, to the target-rich environments up here, and then the targets are seals. The seal population is exploded. You know, I sat back and I said, I would just like to have half the money that they put into studying these things, overhead views, sightings, you know, reports on news, this and that and the other thing, to put towards edifying, realistic training for educational staffs and law enforcement on school shooter events. I don't know if it works on the human psyche on a primal fear level, be it fire. We don't want people, you know, succumbing to injury or death by fire. We don't want to be eaten by something. So we're going to throw a lot of time, money, and resources at those threats. Yet we have something that is killing, you know, hundreds of children. And we can all agree that our children are what? Our community treasures across the board. And if you don't think like that, something's wrong with you, obviously. But,
Al? Take breath, calm yourself. You and I both get worked up talking about this, man, but I can hear your blood pressure going up, and we're in agreement. It would be nice to have those dollars to be able to pay attention to that. You know, I think, I don't know, you can blame the movies for fear of sharks. Most of us have been burned in our life, so being burned in a fire, it's a known feeling. It's a known fear. It's a known threat.
Sure.
It's something we can identify with. Just like being cut, most of us are more afraid of blades than guns. As much as they scare us, most people haven't been shot. Almost everybody's been cut, even if accidentally by themselves. So it's that known visceral fear that's there. And, you know, I think, and thank God, the reality of school violence isn't as realistically appreciated by people because they haven't experienced it or known somebody that experienced it.
It's an intangible threat, but unfortunately, you know, it is tangible. You know, this stuff is happening and will continue to happen. You know, and we really need to I guess, you know, open some eyes at you know, state, local government levels and federal levels maybe, and really, you know, put an impetus on, you know, let's get out there and let's put some preventative maintenance and medicine into this issue. You know, this is real.
Right. Hey, look, we're going to run. We've got a few minutes left, and I'm waiting for my producer to give me the 2-minute warning so I can throw the Hail Mary pass. Let me ask this while we have the time. You know, most of the active shooter response training, like when you and I went to school, it was all developed around responding to the risk that was proven at Columbine. You know, the 2-student shooter model. Has it changed much since then and what you're seeing in the delivery? I mean, it's gotten more realistic with alarms and smoke and you know, people wearing makeup to make them look injured and stuff like that. But other than that, do we really – have we changed our protocols or our tactics to your awareness?
Some are. Most aren't. I think what we need to fall back on is we really need to push a good, solid base of training on combat mindset and skill at arms, Frank. You know, you know, by FBI, UCR, standard 90% of us work in police agencies under 50 officers. That four-man diamond, that four-man wedge, that T, whatever you want to call it, might be a good, solid tactic, but it might be too heavy a tactic to form for some of these small agencies with seven or eight guys in rural areas that can't put that together. I think what we need to do is empower our folks at the academy level, and then once they get to the departments on an in-service level, on just maintaining, you know, that those perishable skills. You can have all the cool, slick training and tactics you want, but if you can't hit what you're shooting at, we got a problem.
I agree with you 100%, and I think we really do need to put a heavier emphasis on the warrior mindset. I mean, and I know you'll agree with me on this. We
absolutely.
We spent so long embracing risk management and being a kindler, gentler nation, and that applied to law enforcement as well. And it's a constant battle we fight today with our fear of being sued or administratively disciplined or whatever it might be, that there's so much emphasis on not doing harm unnecessarily, obviously, and that's proper. I agree with that. I don't think we should just be out here beating people up because we're bored that day. But, you know, when the time comes that we do need to pull the trigger to stop a threat to keep children from being killed, then we need to do it without hesitation. And I don't want to say we need to be eager, but we don't need to be hesitant. We need to be going into it. All right, I got my 2-minute warning, so I know where I'm at. I think we need to take our training to a little bit more of the militaristic approach. Would you agree?
I don't. Some of the training methodologies, yes. I just think we need to stick with keep it simple, stupid. We need to teach these kids a strong baseline of primary marksmanship skills. We need to embed in them the tactics, basic tactics, combat mindset. You know, like we always say, you know, without that good, solid tennis backhand, you have no tennis game. Without that good, solid golf swing, you have your handicaps to the roof. Hey, our society mandates that if we have to employ deadly force, that we are efficient and proficient at it. And sometimes I don't think we're holding up our end of the bargain as well as we should or we could be.
I'm going to have to agree with you, and we're going to have to stop there. We'll have to talk about this more another time. We're down to our final 10 seconds before break. Thanks for coming on the show.
Great talking to you, Frank. Thank you for your service. I think you do a lot of thanking, but you don't get thanked a lot enough. So,
stay safe, Al.
Take care, bud.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these. Homeschooling? Have questions? Get your pen and paper ready. It's the sociable homeschooler, Vivian McNinney. Fridays at 5, 4 Central on TogiNet.com. After a handsome blue-eyed Texan fell in love with Vivian at the Victoria Station in London, she found herself at DFW Airport with a tiny suitcase and a snazzy little duffel bag. Well, 25 years later, she is now happily married to that blue-eyed cowboy. They have 4 grown children, ages 24 to 18, who became willing guinea pigs when she unwittingly stumbled upon the world of homeschooling. Wildflower Academy flourished for 15 years. They survived and thrived, and you can too. Vivian will be covering a wide range of issues that face homeschoolers. What do you do with kids in the summer? How to set up your one-room schoolhouse? How obedience is paramount? And what to do with those snakes? Plus, she'll be sharing ideas and insights that she gleaned from other homeschoolers. So join us for an engaging hour with the sociable homeschooler, Vivian McNinney. Friday afternoons at 5, 4 Central on TogiNet.com.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. Join thousands of other law enforcement professionals attending Police Week, May 12th through the 17th, 2012, in Washington, D.C. The new Officer World Expo at Police Week will offer training, conference sessions, and networking opportunities to better equip those who protect others. Visit OfficerWorldExpo.com because some records aren't meant to be broken.
Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
Welcome back, folks, to our second segment of today's show. As a reminder, we are open for phone calls. The number is 877-864-4869. Give us a shot. Let us know if you have any thoughts, comments, or observations. For this segment of the show, we're going to welcome Mr. Vaughn Baker of Strategos International. Vaughn is a veteran SWAT officer, trainer, and he's president of Strategos International, which is a well-known and highly respected training organization operating internationally. How are you doing this afternoon, Vaughn?
Doing really good, Frank. Thanks for having us.
I appreciate you coming on the show. Listen, I don't know if you heard Sergeant Garcia and I talking earlier. We've been discussing active shooter response evolution, and I know Strategos takes somewhat of a different approach than some companies, and we're going to discuss that. But let me ask you something. You've been training, doing this active shooter training across the nation for the past decade. Have you seen any significant differences in how some states or regions do business, if you will, what their protocols are, what their tactics are?
Yeah, there's some variances and differences. The good news is virtually all across the country, everybody's transitioned over to this rapid deployment approach, meaning patrol officers are going to be the ones responding to these types of incidents. As far as what level each state or each region has taken at, it varies. One of the best that I've seen is in Missouri, what they've done with the Missouri Homeland Security is they've provided training to not only local law enforcement, but also school personnel brought into one class to teach each organization how to respond based on what their needs and their resources are to these sorts of events. In other words, how can we as a community response effectively respond by, one, the school personnel, because they are really the true first responders. They're there when the event occurs.
Yeah, they are.
And then the law enforcement response, how can they make sure their planning does not conflict with what school personnel is going to do? So bringing them both together in one setting has been very positively received.
That's good to hear. And I'll tell you, because I've made presentations to several different school board organizations, and it's interesting to hear the people comment. The staff and faculty comment and say, well, we never know what the police are going to do. Our local officers haven't come in and talked to us or haven't coordinated with us. And it's sad to see or hear, because if we're not working cohesively together, then we're not being as efficient as we can be in our responses.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me ask you this. I don't know if you still are. Are you still sworn and working, Vaughn?
Yeah, I'm still doing some reserve time, so I've got to get my fix occasionally.
I know that, Jones, all too well. Well, I know you were a SWAT officer, and when the active shooter revolution first started, I heard some SWAT guys that were upset. They thought they would lose some work. They thought that, they might lose a touch of that specialty. Did you ever perceive that, or hear anybody voicing that concern?
No, I certainly didn't perceive it because, for one, there's very few instances when law enforcement has been the true direct resolution to the event, to an active shooter type event. Most of the time when SWAT gets called, it's a dynamic event that is now static, meaning either barricade or negotiation of some sort, and they call SWAT in to surround, contain it, and essentially use your time talk tactics strategy. But there's only been six or seven of these type of active shooter events resolved by direct resolution of law enforcement and a traditional response. I never got that feeling hey, this is going to take away from some of my work.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, because I know we were talking about the rapid response, the rapid deployment activities having to go on. I know that as an instructor, I was warned up front that there would be patrol officers I met that simply weren't going to be capable. They wouldn't have the guts, pure and simple, to go run towards the sound of shots. And we always had the solution, we're going to let them work the radio or guide people out of the building or whatever we're going to do. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot and ask you if you have a feeling or opinion about that outlook.
Well, you know, that's the reality. You'd like to think that wasn't the case, but one of the things we really try to focus on in our training, particularly training where we only have a one day with them, and that's to really work on their mindset, because it really didn't matter what their skill set is. If they don't have the mindset to deal with this kind of problem, it doesn't matter what they bring to the table from a skill set capability. So from a mindset point of view, we need to understand from the attacker's point of view why he selected that location. And that is, he didn't select that location because he was looking for a fight. And we illustrate to them that many times, if you will just make yourself present, meaning this is what we call an indirect resolution by law enforcement, if they will just make an effort to get there and get in and get after it from a mindset point of view and realize there's people in there that can't protect themselves and don't have the resources you do, these guys will do the hard work for you, meaning once they become aware of your presence, they will go ahead and self-inflict. And we see about 90% of these guys committing suicide, and most of those aren't because they've been in a situation where they were presented by law enforcement. They either run out of targets, run out of ammo, or they're presented with a fight. If they were looking for a fight, they wouldn't have picked that location, the church, the school, the rest home. They would have showed up at the police station, but they're just not doing that. They're showing up at these places where they perceive a large number of victims are present or people that will act like victims.
Right. I 100% agree with you, but I'm going to go ahead and put myself out there on a limb, and I'll tell you, I've said this in more presentations than I can count. I mean, I'm a policeman. I've got kids, and I'm lunatic enough that when we needed to teach police officers that they might have to shoot children, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids, I couldn't find a target of a kid that we could get cops to shoot at. So I took a picture of my 14-year-old son at the time and had it blown up into posters, and that's what I took to the range to teach people to shoot, to teach police officers, if this is what your job requires, this is what you've got to do. Because traditionally we don't emotionally prepare police officers for the reality of having to take a juvenile life, which might be the reality that we're faced with. Is anybody else dealing with that emotional reality that you're aware of?
You know, not that I'm aware of. It's really what the intent of the person that's doing it. But we focus on schools, however, but we need to understand this isn't just in a school event. I know just within churches alone, we've seen over a 500% increase as far as in-progress violent events over the last 3 years in faith-based organizations. So I 100% agree with what you said there in preparing people for that reality of having to take the life to de-escalate an event of somebody that could be a young teenager or even before a preteen. So I totally agree with that philosophy of preparing him for that possibility.
It's a difficult thing to do, and I do get a lot of strange looks. It's kind of funny. Even the producers let me know that was quite a surprise to her to hear those words come out of my mouth. But you know, we don't have any other choice. And I've told people, because God knows I love my kids, and as far as I'm concerned, if you're a police officer who's taken that oath and put on that badge, and your job is to protect and serve, then by God, you'd better be able to run into those bullets and protect my children. And if you're not willing to do that, then find a new job. That's kind of my outlook as a parent. Now, as a cop, you know, my outlook is if it's my 13-year-old that's doing the hunting and killing, you better take him out quick, because I don't want to live with – I mean, as much as I don't want to lose my son, I don't want to live with the grief that he can cause all those other families either. It's just so much emotional attachment to it. Now, with Strategos, though, you guys do something different. You don't just train law enforcement. So – You also train church organizations, school organizations, business organizations, and so on. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And then we classify that as training who are the true first responders, or who are the people that need to know what to do the most based on they're the ones present when this incident occurs.
Okay. Now, how is that being accepted by the law enforcement organizations that you do business with? Are you getting any pushback on that as a problem?
No. And again, we're not teaching them. We're not saying equip your people at the door with belt feds and deal with them that way, but we're talking about not only lockdown. Most schools have a good plan in place for lockdown, but where most schools don't have is what to do when lockdown fails. And most of our mass casualty events that have occurred across the country have either been as a result of lockdown failure, or they never had a chance to get locked down. In other words, they were the first room that the event started in, and the person didn't present himself as a threat until they got to that room. So we teach them what to do when lockdown fails through a three-out approach, which would be lockout and how do I get out of this area. And then the third out would be, hey, no way to get out, and I'm not successful in locking out. Now, how do I take out, meaning what do I have available to me that I can fight back with? Knowing that he came here looking for a victim, I'm going to let him know through my actions, sorry, there's no victims here. And from a group response or from just a few people that are willing to fight for their lives, and they've already answered that question of who in my life is there worth living for, that's a pretty capable group of individuals, even if it's three or four. You're talking about taking on some people that are highly motivated to prove that I bet you I want to live worse than you want to kill me.
Yeah, ask the people on Flight 93. But I love the approach. You know, I can't imagine that. I've got a son. My son's in eighth grade, my youngest boy, and he brings his homework every night, hopefully like all the other kids do. And I've picked up his textbooks, and I can't imagine walking into a room and having four or more of those kids pelt me with those textbooks. It'd be like being stoned in the Middle Ages.
Oh, yeah. Well, not only textbooks, but, I mean, there's all kinds. Even something that would be a Nerf ball. You say, well, that's not going to hurt when it hits the guy. Well, if it's all you have, bottom line is, as that thing's flying through the air, that adversary doesn't have time to determine in his mind, is that going to hurt when it gets here? They're going to flinch. It's going to change their shooting platform and change their priorities in terms of, hey, I came here looking for victims, and all of a sudden there's no victims here.
Right. And you know, to me, in my world, in my way of thinking, I'd rather my son go out with a fight than be a willing victim. You know, having gone down to Virginia Tech and talked to some of those guys, it's sad to hear about people who go out without any defense of their life, without any even if it's purely defensive action or escape action. They just don't take any action. They just sit and they deal with it. And I guess I'll talk about that after the next break when we're done. This training kids to be willing victims. It's sad, but
first, let me just expand on that. One of the things we actually tell people, this is kind of like the coach. My partner has this illustration. He uses Mark Warren. And he says it's kind of like the coach coaching the soccer goalie. Hey, you may get beat, but by gosh, you better get beat doing something. You don't get beat doing nothing.
Exactly. And you know, I could expound on that forever, and we would bore our listeners into tears. all right, so how long has Strategos International been around, Vaughn?
Well, we were founded in 2002, but we've been doing active shooter rapid deployment training since 2001. And kind of getting back to the evolution of law enforcement response, it's kind of interesting how this has evolved. The reason SWAT teams came about and the reason we weren't successful in Columbine is because it was, hey, surround it, contain it, wait for SWAT. But the reason SWAT teams came about was in 66, primarily after the Texas Tower Sniper down in Austin, Texas. And they decided as law enforcement, we need SWAT teams to deal with this kind of threat. But guess what? We had just proved in that incident that a couple of motivated road officers that had the right mindset and some very, very basic hardware could resolve an incident like that.
That's where we're going to have to end the thought. It does take just motivated people with the right heart, the right mindset, and maybe the right equipment, and we can neutralize this threat. Thanks for being on the show with me today. Stay safe, all right? I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks, Frank.
And we'll be back after this break.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. 152. The number of law enforcement fatalities in 2010. The numbers are too high. Any line of duty death is unacceptable. Join us in Washington, D.C. next year during National Police Week at the first ever Officer World Expo as we combine a unique training opportunity with the largest police memorial in the United States. Visit OfficerWorldExpo.com for details and to join the mailing list. Officer World Expo, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
Parents, if you feel overloaded, overworked, underappreciated, and seriously stressed out, the Parents Plate is here to help you. The Parents Plate with Brenda Nixon. Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet. It's time to build stronger families through parent empowerment. And that's what the Parents Plate does. The Parents Plate understands the busyness of life and balancing child rearing and other commitments. Brenda Nixon will be talking to noted experts and authors on all issues, from teething to teen driving. Brenda Nixon is a nationally recognized speaker to parents and child care professionals and author of the award-winning The Birth to Five book.
From Fox 4 in Kansas City to schools and synagogues to businesses to bookstores, conferences to churches, audiences rave that Brenda engages, educates, and encourages. For more information on Brenda and her books, check out her website, brendanixon.com. The Parents Plate is loaded with information and affirmation. The Parents Plate with Brenda Nixon, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on toginet.com.
Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Morelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
All right, guys, welcome back, guys and gals, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters in blue, brown, green, or whatever shade of uniform you wear. Thank you for being with us today. If you have a comment, observation, want to call in, 877-864-4869 is our number. We're going to close up today. We've got about 15 minutes of the show left, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this history of active shooter. And Vaughn Baker, we were just talking about this, how in 1966, the Texas Tower incident, it took two motivated officers with the right heart to go and neutralize Charles Whitman, the guy who was doing the shooting. And now we're back to that. You know, we've got to teach people to be aggressive and to go face the threat and to do what it takes to not be victims, but not being a victim means being an aggressor. So we had to evolve into that. It's a shame. I think it took us 30 years to do it. So we look back to 1966, and we see that SWAT teams get developed, and it changes the response protocol for the patrol people. Now they just set up a perimeter and they hold their position and they wait. And it stayed that way until 1999 when Columbine occurred and the public outcry demanded that we change how we do business. And we're still evolving how we do business, if you will. It's always been noted that SWAT is a little bit more militaristic in appearance. Their equipment and their operations and stuff is more military-oriented than regular patrol. But with active shooter response evolution, we've had to put some patrol folks – we've had to adopt a few of those militaristic things, if you will. The idea of rifles instead of only handguns, because we don't want to be outgunned by the bad guys. Heavier body armor, helmets. These are things that we used to never think we would see police officers in the United States, normal, regular police officers. And yes, SWAT officers are a special set of people. If you don't have any friends that are SWAT cops, get to know them a little bit and you'll realize what I mean. But we always thought that you could tell them apart. When it comes to performance for active shooter, certainly the SWAT operators would be the more highly trained, but the performance, if we do what we're supposed to do, will be the same. The patrol guys will respond, move to the sound of shots, and neutralize the threat. That's what we're supposed to be doing. So from 66 to 99, though, we had shootings that occurred in 76, 79, 82, 83, 87, 88, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98. That's at least one every year in the 90s. Four shootings in the 80s, two in the 70s. How did we go from an average of 15 years between attacks, when you look at 1891 to 1966, to multiple attacks every year? What changed? Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, if you all have heard his presentation, will swear it's video games and television. I'm not sure he's wrong. I'm not sure that's the only reason. But this prevalence of violence shown to younger children, it may have an impact. Video games, I'm not a big believer in first shooter video games teaching people to kill. It might affect their mindset. Light gun games that improve certain pieces of marksmanship skills might make them better shooters if they're of the mindset to shoot. I think it's a sociological problem that's probably larger than a simple cop like me can try to resolve. I just teach people how to move to the sound of shots, neutralize the suspects, and keep them from hurting children more. But in 99, as we know, Columbine occurred. 36 casualties there, 12 killed, 24 wounded. Harrison Klebold committed suicide rather than face the police, just like Sung Hee Cho did in Virginia Tech. you know, like Vaughn said, these people are looking for victims. They're not looking for a fight. If they wanted a fight, they'd walk into the police station. But Columbine was different because of the satellite coverage, the number of personal media devices are out here today, cell phones inside and outside the school. The number of deaths that occurred after law enforcement arrival and perimeter was set, and the ongoing threat to children while law enforcement stayed secure. Now, that's not criticism. The responding officers did what they had been trained to do, what policy and protocol demanded that they do. Public outcry now mandated that we change how we do business. And we made that change. The ongoing active shooter response training nationwide has been evidence of that change. So now we have the active shooter immediate response protocols that we follow. Like Vaughn talked about, largely it's a 4 or 5 man diamond. I know at one point Strategos was teaching a T and a modified Y or Y and a modified T, whatever they called it. I've never had their class, in all honesty. I've had other training with Strategos. The bottom line is we've got to put some people in a building to move to the sound of the shots and neutralize the subjects. It just boils down to that. I'll make a very unpopular statement. If you wear a badge and children are being killed and you don't have the guts to go face the rounds being fired to save children's lives, you're not worthy of the oath you took. Go find another job. And I'll take phone calls, I'll take emails, I'll take the hate mail, whatever you want to send. If you're not capable of facing a threat after taking that oath to protect and serve, if you're not willing to do that, you don't belong wearing a badge. Go find another line of employment. Just my outlook. And speaking of the children, you know, we teach our kids now with zero tolerance policy. It's been around for 25, 30 years. We teach our children not to fight back, even in self-defense in schools. I have this conversation with my children, my youngest sons now. I've had it with I have 4 children total. Of all the principals I've talked to through the years start to blur. My youngest son now, he brings handbook to, you know, it's a school discipline handbook and the student guidance. And one of the rules is always fighting is unacceptable for any reason, period. And I'll change the period to a comma and I'll put except in self-defense. And then I'll have him sign it and I'll sign it. And if the principal wants to talk to me about it, then I will. But I'm a firm believer that we can't teach our children to be willing victims and then be surprised that they don't fight back 15 or 20 years later. I mean, think about this. Little Johnny's in kindergarten. He's on the playground. Somebody comes over and pushes him down and takes the ball he's playing with. And he goes and tells the teacher, he gets up, he pushes the kid back, he takes the ball, and then he gets punished like the other kid gets punished. They both get punished. One gets punished for having committed an aggressive act that was unkind, that was cruel, that was bullying, going and pushing a kid down to take the ball. Little Johnny got up, and he did the same thing in return. He pushed the kid, and he took his ball. Was either one of them right? Certainly the first kid wasn't right. Whether or not little Johnny was right, it's a matter of moral perception. But they both get punished. A week later, when that first kid comes back to push little Johnny down to take the ball, little Johnny never gives him a chance. Kid goes to push him. Little Johnny doesn't drop the ball. He moves to the side. He pushes the kid away. They're both punished again. Little Johnny's being taught you don't do anything except being pushed down and giving up that ball. Years later, little Johnny's not so little anymore. He's a middle schooler, and somebody decides they want to take his coat. And he says, nah, you can't have my coat. They try to take it forcefully. He fights back. He's defending himself from essentially a armed robbery, strong arm robbery, if you will. And he gets punished for that. And what's he taught? Don't defend yourself. Don't defend your property. Let's change that to little Jane and little Judy. She's been taught don't defend yourself. Don't fight back. And she's in college now and some guy wants to rape her. What is she going to do? Have we trained her to be a willing victim? Have we taught her through the school system not to fight back? What happens when the school shooter comes in? Have we taught students to be willing victims? We certainly, if we have, we got to stop. Children have to be taught it's okay to defend yourself against a violent threat. And again, I'll welcome the hate mail. I'll welcome the phone calls. I'll welcome, you know, the comments and the criticisms. I've taught my children this. If you can walk away from a problem in the school, walk away from it. If you can't walk away from it, you try to talk your way out of it. If you can't walk away and you have talking's not working, then you better win. Don't be the willing victim. And when I said that in New Jersey, I got a standing ovation from the School Resource Officers Association and the state superintendent of schools. I commended him at that time for that. I couldn't believe it. We can't let our kids learn to be victims. Coming back to active shooter resolution, how we've evolved our response tactics, getting down off my soapbox. And thank you for listening to me, putting up with that. If you disagree, give me a call, 877-864-4869. If you agree, same number. All right, active shooter response today. Like Vaughn said, the true first responders are in the schools already, or in the church, or in the business building. If they don't resolve the situation, active shooter response, active shooter situation is most likely going to be resolved by patrol with a non-traditional response using a minimum number of officers. They've got to be properly equipped. They've got to be properly trained. They have to be aware of the possibility to transition to a barricade situation, which is more than difficult. And I say this from experience, having been through active shooter instructor school twice now. Both times here in Southern Maryland, excellent training. I went in 2001, way back then, and then again just last year as a refresher. The training's come a long way. Now, rather than just having a little bit of tactics and protocols, we've evolved the training to include smoke, alarms, injured children. What do you call it, stuff, melange, whatever, the makeup that makes them look like they're wounded, they have broken bones, stuck out puddles of blood, people screaming. We've made it more realistic, and we need to keep that up. The training has to be right. The equipment has to be right. But when you're in the midst of that and your heart's going about 150 beats a minute and you can barely hear your partners on your team and you're trying to move to the sound of shots, when you hear a door slam and the guy behind the door is now screaming, "Don't come in or I'll kill them," it's a barricade situation. But it is really, really hard to stop, especially if you hear another gunshot anywhere, and not breach the door to continue with your actions, your attempt to neutralize the threat. That dividing line is difficult, and it's something that has to be highly trained if we're going to have that expectation. Our priorities have to be in this order, is my opinion. Again, I'll take your input. Capture or neutralization of the subject as soon as possible. We have to protect the lives of those in proximity to the shooter. We have to protect the lives and the safety of the citizens in the area. Only after all of that do we have to worry about the safety of the police officers, containing the situation, and then the after-event investigation and a return to normalcy. Those priorities. Fourth on the list is officer safety. Active shooter response has certainly evolved a long way in the last 10 years. Thank you for listening to our radio show about it today. Next week, we're going to talk about communications and how that's evolved. I look forward to having you guys back in our audience then. Thank you for your time. Stay safe on the streets, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for being a part of Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com. And hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Each week, Officer Radio is your source for the latest news, trends, and issues facing the law enforcement community. Join us each week as Officer Borelli and his guest examine, dissect, and discuss the issues facing our industry. Call in live to join the conversation and to get your voice heard. Join us every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Officer.com.